So today, we are beginning a series of sermons on what are called the I Am sayings of Jesus. So in the Gospel of John, between John chapter 6 and 15, we hear Jesus declaring, I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world, I am the door of the sheep pen, I am the good shepherd, I am the resurrection and the life, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I am the true vine. John, the gospel, is very different compared to the other gospels. And John tells different stories and in different order. And I have a theory why. So instead of being like a biography, like Luke writing to tell someone who didn't know Jesus, to tell them what Jesus was about, I believe that John was actually a collection of sermons that John preached to his church in Ephesus as their pastor. And the book was put together by his congregation after John had been exiled by the emperor, or maybe even after he died, partly to remember Jesus through the stories that John told them, but also partly to remember John, their beloved pastor, the disciple whom Jesus loved, for bringing these firsthand stories about Jesus to them. So for the first people who put the stories together, when they hear Jesus declare, I am the way, the truth, and the life, they're not hearing it as a sales pitch to Christianity for people who are undecided about Jesus. These people don't need to be sold on Jesus because they have already gone all in with Jesus. They were already experiencing Jesus as the way, the truth, and the life. And they were living life with Jesus. They have found him faithful. And they wanted the world to know that John's firsthand stories with Jesus had become their firsthand stories with Jesus. All the words in John's gospel are John's, but they're also the declaration and the testimony of a congregation of their experience of Jesus and what they know to be true about him. So over the next few weeks, as we go through Jesus' I Am declarations as another congregation, what Jesus says may be new to some people listening, but for those of us here who don't need convincing about Jesus' claims about himself, what we get to do is to reflect on all the ways Jesus have been true and faithful as the I Am to us. And maybe we will also hear the Spirit affirm to us that in the new ways that we find ourselves needing God, in whatever new season of life we find ourselves in, God is still the I Am. And he will be again in the ways we need him to be. Now, the end of John chapter 8 records a confrontation between Jesus and the religious authorities. They question his teachings, his credentials, and accuse him of being demon-possessed. And Jesus rebuts them by saying he not only knows God, but he is the one true obedient Son of God. And in fact, he pre-exists every created thing, including Abraham, the founding father of the Jewish people. So he says, before Abraham was born, I am, Jesus says. Now Jesus says, I am that way for two reasons. The first reason is that he's deliberately echoing how God introduced himself to Moses. So back in Exodus chapter 3, when God appeared to Moses in the burning bush and recruited him to rescue Abraham's descendants who had been living as slaves in Egypt, God told Moses to go and tell the slaves that God was heartbroken watching the hard life. He had decided to rescue them out of Egypt and take them to a good piece of land where they can live as free people. And Moses says to God, if I tell them God sent me, they are going to ask me, who is this God who sent you? And God says, just tell them I am has sent you. When Jesus says I am, he's hoping that the Jewish people would hear and recognize the timbre of God's voice behind that. You know, back in the days when telephones have wires and hang on kitchen walls, and we have to answer the phones for the other people living in the house? I can remember answering the phone and people confusing me with my mom. This was before puberty. And then after puberty, people would confuse me with my dad. Did that happen to you? This is Jesus sounding exactly the way God sounded to Moses, hoping the people would make the connection. So when I was working as an engineer, a new co-worker invited us over to his house for dinner. When I showed up at his house, his six-year-old precocious daughter greeted us at the door. So I'm meeting this little girl for the first time, and I said hello. And then for some reason, I said, "Well, who do you look like?" She put her hands on her hips, screwed up her face, and she said, "I look like myself." I was so put in my place. I never, ever said that to a kid again. Now, psychologists call this differentiation. It's the process of becoming your own person apart from your parents. So this kid was already doing it at six and in many ways ahead of me in my 20s. This is the opposite of what Jesus means by I am. He has no need to differentiate himself from his dad. He comes to tell us that he is sent by God. He speaks as God's official representative. He is exactly like his father in the way he loves us, in the way he's faithful, in the way he's committed, completely committed to our well-being. So this is the theme of John's gospel, his box set of sermons. To establish Jesus' identity and mission as the one and only true Son of God. So John 1:1 says, in the beginning, Jesus was there. Jesus was there with God, and Jesus was of the same stuff as God. He gave us life, and he has come to give us life again. And so by the time we get to John 6, we have a bunch of sermons arranged around this cryptic name of God, I am, where Jesus sort of fills in the blank, so there would be no ambiguity. So for example, in John 6, Jesus famously fed 5,000 people with a few sardines and dinner rolls, and then had 12 baskets left over. And then he tells his disciples, "I am the bread of life. Let me feed your whole person, not just your stomach." And John tells us seven stories like this in his time with Jesus, and in each time, Jesus would fill in the I am with a declaration about why God sent him to us. Now, there's a second reason why Jesus says I am and why it matters. When we list the I ams together, it feels like a memorial quotes on stone monuments, kind of like when Popeye says, "I am." What does he say? "I am what I am, and that's all what I am." He's saying, don't expect me to be different or more than I am. What a catch, right? Husband material. But this is exactly the opposite of what God means when he says, "I am what I am, that I am." When Moses asks God who God is, God says, "I am that I am," meaning I am what I always have been. Since the day I made my friendship pact with Abraham, I am right now being what you need me to be. Your rescuer from the tyranny of the Pharaoh and a hard life. And I am going to be whatever you need me to be. When we leave Egypt and enter the scary unknown of the wilderness, I will be everything you need as we trek to the land I have prepared for you. Everything you need to then build a life there as free people. And from here on in, whatever life throws at you, you will find I am whatever you need me to be. When God says he is the I am to Moses, he means he's not just one thing, for one time, for one situation. Rather, he's everything we need him to be in the ever-changing circumstances of our lives. And when Jesus fills in the blanks of this I am declaration, he's saying, here is God again, coming to you amidst your new challenges, being what you need him to be, so you can find life again. If there's one thing we know for sure, is that change is always happening. It's what scientists call entropy. Nothing ever stays the same. When God and Jesus declare I am, he's emphatically saying he's always bigger and tougher and smarter than the problems we get into. God is never surprised or stumped. Even if we may not see something coming or cannot imagine how bad things can get. God cannot become obsolete or outdated, like new technology. God is endlessly capable of adapting and enlarging himself to become the solution we need. And 1,500 years after God says, I am to Moses, to embolden him for the trek through the wilderness, here's Jesus saying, I am, to another generation of people with a whole new set of problems. And if there's a theme to all the I ams, it's that because Jesus, God, sees our pain and feels our pain, Jesus comes to offer us life if we want it. A fuller, more purposeful, more deeply connected life to God and each other. And if history is any indication, the people in the first century who chose to follow Jesus did just that. They didn't just come alive, they brought life to the world. The world Jesus is born into, it's very different than the one that Moses was in when God showed up in the burning bush. If there's one word to describe Jesus' world, it would be claustrophobic. There's the oppressive empire that tends to stifle individual freedom and would violently slap down the people who step out of line. There are pagan religions that require people to do religious rituals to appease moody, unpredictable gods, because when these gods get angry, they would unleash diseases and earthquakes and famines, and they're told, when you slack off with your religion, people will die, and it would be your fault. The charge of that crime is called hatred of humanity, for causing the world to suffer because you're not going to temple enough, because you're not giving enough offerings or burning enough incense, or you're praying to the wrong gods. And then there's the stifling living condition. All Roman cities start out as forts, so they're at most 2 square miles. A typical Roman city has a density of 200 people per acre. Compare that with Manhattan, which has 100 people per acre, but they're stacked up in high-rises. Tokyo has 25 people per acre, which is about the same as Hong Kong or Wuhan. We, by contrast, have 700,000 people living in 44 square miles. That's a definitely spacious 2.5 persons per acre. So if you think those new apartments are tiny, the average Roman residents are packed into cubicles that's about the size of their beds. These cubbyholes are stacked between streets that are really just narrow laneways, strewn full of garbage and strayed animals. So it's not surprising when somebody gets sick. In Roman times, everybody gets sick. The life expectancy is about 30. When people hear that some disease is starting to spread in your Roman city, it's common practice to run to the hills, even if you're the doctor, and even if the sick person is your wife or your child. There's no running water for common people, so since you have to walk a distance with your jug to get water, you tend to ration water for drinking rather than washing. And since you have to walk a distance to dispose of your sewage, most people just dump it out the window at night, even though it's illegal. So there are stories of the odd person walking around at night who get hit overhead with a bucket of poop. But few people go out at night because it's just not safe. Robbers would not hesitate to take a life after they take your wallet. People burn wood for cooking and heating, and they also burn incense to cover up the bad smells. So the air is thick and sooty. Sooty, is it something like that? Yeah, you know what I mean. Because people die young, there are constantly new people moving into town to replenish the population. So people don't stick around long enough to foster long-term relationships. So these are cramped cities of strangers where people just keep to themselves and keep their noses down. So if you're in a bind, there's no one you can call on for help, because you don't know anyone well enough who would put out for you. So this is the world Jesus comes into and why he came, to bring oxygen to a world that's suffocating, a world where people are obsessed with not getting sick and obsessed with healing if they're sick, and they're anxious about what calamity is waiting to hit them around the corner, and they pray to the gods, desperate for answers, depressed when they don't know what the gods want. And Jesus steps into this world and announces, I'm the life, the way to life. Follow me and I will show you how to come alive. For the people who accepted Jesus' invitation to follow after him, something happened to them from the inside out. It wasn't just because they believed in Jesus' resurrection so they weren't afraid to die. And it wasn't just sermons telling them to be better people. They found the courage and an energy to become agents of life and blessing. When a plague hits town and everybody is getting sick, instead of fear and despair, the Christians mobilize. They formed networks and tended to the sick neighbors who had been abandoned by their family. Because instead of cowering in the face of calamities of different kinds, they saw these calamities as a dare to their trust and reliance on God. And they saw troubles as opportunities to serve people and love like Jesus. They wanted to show the world these things were no match for the great I Am and his love. And wherever Christians sprang into action, sick people would recover. There was no magic potion. People got better simply because there was someone there nursing them instead of no one. So the Christians didn't just find life following Jesus. They brought life to the cities. And in the year 362, the Emperor Julian wrote a letter to a pagan high priest and said, why can't you teach your people to be more like the Christians in their virtue and their kindness to strangers? So this is the difference that Jesus made to the people in the world 2,000 years ago. And Jesus is God being the I Am to the world, that the world needed God to be to a suffering people, so they can find God again and come alive. God, the Father, Son, and Spirit is still the I Am in our world, in our time. And as we hear Jesus say that to us, I am what you need me to be, what new things do we need God to be for us? What new ways do we need God to give us life for the new things that rob us of it? And as God adapts and enlarges himself to bring life in the 21st century, as God is what we need him to be, are we being what God needs us to be so we can be his hands and feet and be bringers of blessing and good news to the world? Jesus came to us to bring us life because we need him to. One day in 1966, during the Vietnam War, Charlie Company ran into an ambush and lost 80% of the soldiers and wounded the rest. It was such an awful day for those who survived it that they have had PTSD ever since that day. So in the middle of this mayhem, a 22-year-old medic named William Pitzenbarger dropped from a helicopter to treat the wounded. And as bullets flew, he took off his own armor vest and put it on one of the wounded soldiers. Then he piled dead bodies on top of live ones to shield them from enemy fire. And he loaded the most wounded soldiers onto a gurney to be hoisted up to the helicopter. When the helicopter was full, they signaled to Pitzenbarger that it was his turn to pull out. He waved them off. He wanted to stay with the wounded on the ground as they waited for the helicopter to come back. Everybody thought he was crazy. As they held their breath and waited for the helicopter to come back, one of the soldiers asked Pitzenbarger, why are you here? And he said, because you are. Why did Jesus come? Why did Jesus airdrop himself into our messed up world? Why is the Holy Spirit here with us right now? Because we are here. And because we're in pain. And we don't know whether anyone notices or cares. And because God wants us to know he notices and he cares. And he is what we need to heal and to come alive. So as God says, I am to us today, what do we need him to be in a fresh way? Because of the new challenges we're facing. How do we need God to breathe new life in us? What does our 21st century world need from God? And as God is becoming the I Am that our world needs, how is the Spirit remaking us as God's children so we also become bringers of life to our world? I invite you to think on these questions as I read to you the first chapter of John. It's from the voice, and in the voice, Jesus is called the voice. Before time itself was measured, the voice was speaking. The voice was and is God. The celestial word remained ever present with the Creator. His speech shaped the entire cosmos, immersed in the practice of creating. All things that exist were birthed in him. His breath filled all things with a living, breathing light. A light that thrives in the depths of darkness, blazes through murky bottoms. It cannot and will not be quenched. He entered a world he made, yet the world did not recognize him. Even though he came to his own people, they refused to listen and receive him. But for all who did receive and trust in him, he gave them the right to be reborn as the children of God. He bestowed his birthright not by human power or initiative, but by God's will. The voice took on flesh and became human and chose to live among us, alongside us. We have seen him enveloped in undeniable splendor, the one true Son of the Father, evidence in the perfect balance of grace and truth. God, unseen until now, is revealed in the voice. God's only Son, straight from the Father's heart. Amen.